This week's show was brought to you by Eric Johnson, Alex Agnick, Chris Hine, DP, and Leo Nelson. Wow. Thank you for all the subscribers and support this week. If you also enjoy listening to The Whole Rabbit and you'd like to help us keep making shows every single week, head on over to www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where you can hear all our extended episodes, get 2 bonus stickers, and access to our Discord coven where we discuss plans to depose the blind occluded god and incrementally defund the Black Iron Prison. If dismantling the conspiracy is a bit beyond your pay grade, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. Have you ever wondered what makes a horror movie a forever classic? In this case, we dissect what made the original Clive Barker Hellraiser so legendary and poke inside its hidden social commentaries that make it more relevant than ever. You might be shocked to discover how the film unfolds like a puzzle box itself, revealing a tantalizingly dark secret within. We have such sights to show you. So thank you and enjoy the show.
No crying in The Whole Rabbit.
It's not true.
We need to make somebody cry this episode or it's a waste of good suffering.
I'm good at that.
Make me cry. I forgot how, I think.
Hello everybody and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just satisfy ourselves with raindrops and roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, Rubik's cubes settled with simple algorithms, orgies with chocolate girls tied up with string. Nay, we've grown tired and bored of these things, so clear out the attic, prepare for their coming. Le Marchant Box opens to the determined and cunning.
I'm coming. You open the podcast. We came.
What just happened, dude?
In case you haven't figured it out by now, you're about to be subjected to the pleasures and sufferings unending as we dismantle the mad wizard Clive Barker's darkly beautiful puzzle box, Hellraiser. And if you've read the books, it's also known as Hellbound Heart. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, and today I'm joined by the mitochondrial meme queen of canceled cartoons, Mari Sama.
Awoo.
And the lacquered obsidian pope Plagueis himself, Doth Dingus.
What's good?
I'm kind of excited for this episode because I think I know why people like Hellraiser so much.
Oh yeah, what is that?
I think it's the same reason people like to read the Bible during sex and do weird kinky stuff.
That does sound fun. I've never thought of that.
And I'm also kind of excited because this is our 111th episode.
Neato.
It's like 3 magicians.
And it also means death and thick darkness.
Death and thick.
Thick darkness.
Extra thick darkness. Dummy thick darkness.
I've got nothing.
That's just what you're into, Mari.
But honestly, you know what's weird is that the blood in this didn't really bother me. And I think it's because a lot of 80s movies do this where it's so over the top and theatrical that it's almost like looking at an art piece instead of actual gore. It's realistic, but it's not too realistic where I'm like, want to throw up.
Yeah, nowadays it's all CGI.
That's what I'm saying is CGI to me is a little bit too realistic. So it either looks like too fake or it looks too real. Whereas I like the old special effects quite a bit.
And arguably, Pinhead is probably the most iconic original horror movie bad guy of all time. I mean, like what we got, like vampires and all that, but he's a bit newer.
But what about the dude with the medium length hair and the quivering lip from The Purge? He cried when he killed a man. It was
like Pinhead. I could see how this character has such a following now that I've actually seen the movie. He actually has a couple scenes where he seems a little bit benevolent, and that goes into the second one we watch too, but he seems to have some kind of order or purpose because he commands the other Cenobites. Like, he seems to be in charge.
I will say that when he appears benevolent, I think most of the time it's almost sarcastic.
I see what you're saying. Like, it's not really that he's being nice. It's just that he doesn't give a shit about whatever.
Dismissive.
Yeah, he's dismissing it. At the same time, I like in this movie how if you tamper with this box and you summon them, you actually have to answer to it. You know what I mean? Like, otherwise, they're not really interested in that, in other people.
He's like a force of nature, cause and effect.
Yes. There's a rule set, but it's limited to whoever stirs up the shit pot, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And he's one of the most likable horror movie bad guys. Easily of all time.
He is. He's so hammy. Like his delivery on every line is so campy and over the top, but he's also kind of menacing in that way.
In the novel, they sound like nerds.
So it's some kind of like Comic-Con / BDSM convention goers that like found a time machine or an interdimensional space travel thing.
And said, let's go to hell.
Yeah.
Clive Barker describes them as speaking in these high-pitched, fluted voices, a bit like excited little girls.
That's okay. Way more disturbing.
The fact that they end with the word bite almost makes them sound like they're made of information, or they might be mites, like insects. Cenobite, or, it sounds like a bug.
Yeah, or a parasite is what I read them as, like a spiritual parasite.
A functioning piece of a greater entity.
Right, right.
Which they are. In the popular film series, the puzzle box is referred to as the lament configuration. It's said to possess a power to open gates to other worlds and bring its solver into contact with these extra-dimensional intelligences, or Cenobites, and are capable of delivering them the pleasure of either heaven or hell. A lofty promise for the witting and desperate who have exhausted all other means of stimulation. Built by the French toy maker Philippe Le Marchant, the Lament configuration is one of many puzzle boxes created by its maker, all promising to open the invisible gates to other worlds. In the film edition, Le Marchant is a maniac being directed on how to construct the box at the hands of a Cenobite named Baron, but in the novelization, he's merely doing the dirty work of a cruel aristocrat that he serves.
Ooh, I like the other version better.
Interesting that Baron is the name of an aristocrat or a aristocratic ruler.
That's a nice tie-in, yeah.
I find that interesting, too, because it speaks to the theme of hedonism and excess found throughout throughout the movies.
Oh, yeah.
That an aristocrat would have contracted this device.
Because he's so bored with life.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, it sounds like you could contact other entities, though. Is that true?
Well, for instance, there's a box that could take you to Alice's Wonderland.
Or heaven, like you said.
It's a ghost phone.
Okay, so there's different boxes. Okay, that's the second movie. We'll get there.
Whoa, how'd you get here?
I'll ask that question later.
Hey, Fryman, you ever seen this guy before?
That's where I want to go.
No, you don't want to be here.
Oh, Red Star and I have a battle.
I want to go to the hentai world. I don't know. We were just talking about like where these puzzle boxes would take us. I'm just saying.
Well, that's where Frank thinks he's going. He thinks he's going to a place where he is going to be fucked and sucked and licked and served by these big, voluptuous, beautiful women, the kind that he, quote, likes. When the Cenobites ask him, what do you want? He starts to explain and they cut him off. They're like, we know what you want. You're like, they've seen all his thoughts. And then
he got bored in a deviant art picture instead.
In the book, Le Marchant's box is smooth, it's black, it's lacquered, it's reflective on the inside with the faces of its victims. The inside scintillates with a darkness full of chaos that flock like injured ravens. The box must be taken apart entirely to be considered solved, and only a few notches run along the edge that are most difficult to see.
It's an interesting description. Like it's interesting to hear it described as an actual puzzle, because in the movie, it just seems like people poke at it. And it's like the most accessible hell portal in the world.
Yeah.
Because there's no process of solving it.
It's like a dusty fingerprint reader.
Like you could accidentally just open it.
Because they have to sit there and like they like poke it and then they start to rub it a little bit. And then they poke it again and it's like access granted.
It's like a genie lamp with a padlock.
And so in the film, it reconfigures. But in the book, you actually have to take it apart, like the puzzle that the girl is playing with in the second film.
It does that in the first two, I think, like how it unfolds when it's triggered.
But it's always in one piece.
Yeah, it never like breaks apart or anything.
It does break apart in the book.
Ah, so I guess it's supposed to do that.
So
real talk, though.
Yeah.
Before I get to have my rant about the second half of Hellraiser 2 later. That movie would have been 200% better if it was just that girl trying to put a square peg in a round hole.
Aww. Like
30 minutes.
Bless her.
By solving the puzzle, the victim summons the, quote, gash of Cenobites. This is the group that's led by the Hell Priest, who was colloquially nicknamed Pinhead, which Clive Barker really, truly hated. And so Pinhead himself also hates the name and likes to be referred to as the Hell Priest. So,
guys, I'm the Hell Priest.
stop calling me Pinhead. You can just fucking like hear the saliva coming between his teeth when he gets upset.
I'm like, if you didn't want to be called that, then why did you choose that torture?
Because, Mari, there's a system. When you solve the box, you get to have a few options available to you, but mostly you're fucked. First, you can make a bargain with the Cenobite. Two, you can resolve Limashant's configuration. Three, you can commit suicide before they drag you to hell. Or four, if your blood is spilt or there's an object associated with your abduction, it's possible to reconstitute yourself in the real world as seen in the first Hellraiser.
So those are the actual people that came back, right? They're not Cenobites with their body.
Yeah, yeah. Like that was the actual Frank that came back.
Okay. But
he came back out of hell. Presumably.
How come he couldn't grow his skin, but the woman could?
She had to kill a lot more bodies. But I also think it's Clive Barker's statement about imperialism and racism.
Sequelitis.
But it also has something to do with the fact that skin is precious. It's our biggest organ and that we're carbon-based life forms. Carbon is the sixth element on the periodic table, which means that as carbon-based life forms, we are 666, and that's why it's the number of man. So I think it's there for you to contemplate over and over, like, what is with the skin? Like, and Frank needs to be given a skin where Julia has to kill victim after victim after victim after victim to achieve her old skin.
Right.
All I have to add here is, gotta say, didn't think suicide would work.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, it just
I guess purgatory is better than that, you know.
Well, we don't know where you go after that, but
I know, but it could be better than where you were gonna go.
Honestly, don't know. It does sound like people do get to come in hell in this world. So I mean, there's that.
Yeah,
it'd just be from a hook.
When you die in Clive Barker's universe, there's nothing. That's one strong suggestion made in the second film.
Wait, so they're not dead when they go?
They're still carnally and yeah, they still have a body. So it's like another dimension, really.
This is borrowed from the Christian idea of hell. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's another level of being alive.
Because the people in hell are still alive. They're just regenerating their flesh. In fact, their bodies have been joined with their spirit.
It's like a magical life.
Huh, okay.
Instead of, like, your body's enchanted and it can't die. And it's infused with your soul, like a prison. Makes sense, dude. Because that's the only way you could actually feel pain, which is what hell is all about, is about torturing you with that. And there's no release from it, which I guess if you go to heaven, that means that you just release your body and you can leave it.
The interior surfaces were brilliantly polished. Frank's reflection, distorted, fragmented, skated across the lacquer. Limachant, who had been in his time a maker of singing birds, had constructed the box so that opening it tripped a musical mechanism, which began to tinkle a sort of rondo of sublime banality. And I saw when the lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as if it were a noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat unto the Son of Man, having his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, "Thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come, for the harvest is ripe in the earth." And he that sat on the cloud thrust his sickle on the earth, and that earth was reaped. Another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry with him, had a sharp sickle, saying, "Thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe." And the angel thrust his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great wine press of the wrath of God. And the wine press was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the wine press even unto the horse bridles by the space of 2,600 furlongs. So was that? That was actually out of Clive Barker. No, that was the Bible. I'm kidding. That was Revelation specifically.
Where does it say 6,200 furlongs?
I don't know, but it says sickle like 11 times.
That's a lot of times to say sickle, man. I think they're talking about death or some shit like that. It came from them, from the quartet of Cenobites who now, with the wall sealed behind them, occupied the room. a fitful phosphorescence like the glow of a deep sea fish's, blue, cold, and charmless. It struck Frank that he had never once wondered what they would look like. His imagination, though fertile when it came to trickery and theft, was impoverished in other regards. The skill to picture these eminences was beyond him, so he had not even tried. Why then was he so distressed to set eyes upon them? Was it the scars that covered every inch of their bodies? The flesh cosmetically punctured and sliced and infibulated and then dusted down with ash? Was it the smell of vanilla they brought with them, the sweetness of which did so little to disguise the stench beneath? Or was it that as the light grew and he scanned them more closely, he saw nothing of joy or even humanity in their maimed faces, only desperation and an appetite that made his bowels ache to be voided.
And the temple of God was opened in heaven, and there was seen in the temple the ark of his testament, and there were lightnings and voices and thunderings and an earthquake and a great hail.
So after he meets the four Cenobites, or the four cherubic beasts, or the four archangels, they tell him that they're ready to introduce him to the engineer.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if we remember from the text, we talk about an every episode, Plato's Timaeus, the demiurge, the name means public artificer, or as we might call it, an engineer. Okay, so back to Frank's bowels aching to be voided. He felt untold tastes in his tongue, bitter, sweet, sour, salty, smelled spice and shit in his mother's hair, saw cities and skies, saw speed, saw deep, broke bread with men now dead and was scalded by the heat of their spittle on his cheek. And of course there were women. Always amid the flurry and confusion, memories of women appeared, assaulting him with their scents, textures, and tastes. The proximity of this harem aroused him, despite circumstances. He opened his trousers and caressed his cock, more eagerly to have spilled his seed than to be freed of these creatures than for the pleasure of it. Where, too, moments before there had been an empty space, there was now a figure. It was the fourth Cenobite, the one who had never spoken nor shown its face. Not a he saw now, but a she. The hood it had worn was now discarded, as has been the robes. The woman beneath was gray, yet gleaming, her lips bloody, her legs parted, so the elaborate scarification of her pubis was displayed. She sat on a pile of rotting human heads and smiled in welcome. The collision of sensuality and death appalled him. Could he have any doubt that she had personally dispatched these victims? The rot was beneath her nails, their tongues 20 or more lay out in ranks of her oiled thighs as if waiting for entrance. Did he not doubt that the brains now seeping from their ears and nostrils had been driven to insanity before a blow or a kiss had stopped their hearts? Oh, so you finished dreaming. She stood up. The tongues fell on the floor like a rain of slugs. Now we can begin, she said.
Ooh, creepy. She reminds me of Call
hard right now.
Ew.
That seriously puts the movie to shame, though.
Yeah, wow. It's much better.
I mean, it's like, it really does capture like the grotesque kind of overindulgence that was described.
Yeah, it reminds me of Kali.
It absolutely does. How she wears the skulls around her neck and
sits on them, too. And the tongues and stuff.
She's flicking her tongue, yeah.
Yeah.
She has a
body which is kind of like the opposite. Life and blood is red and pink. So a lifeless body would be like pale and like bluish colored.
We know that the Aghori Hindu culture cover themselves in the ash of the dead and eat the poo-poo and meditate upon dead bodies in order to understand the sacredness of that which is also grotesque.
They also wear and decorate their environment with skulls and smoke weed all day, every day.
I wonder if the engineer grows really good weed.
Ah, man, he probably makes wax. He's an engineer. He's not a gardener.
It's a she.
Oh, she. Well, you know, I watched the movie, damn it.
Yeah, I thought it was the old guy.
Movie, it is the homeless man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Who's like the hermit, which is actually a more Christian representation of God, where the film itself is sort of, in my opinion, making a commentary about, well, the treatment of the goddess in Revelations and the treatment of the ancient mysteries and how they've been recapitulated as evil. When in reality, the angels of Revelations are, well, they've got a lot of sickles. They're kind of badass. And they've come to reap the blood, so to speak.
Angels to some, demons to others.
Travelers on the limits of experience.
Yeah, something like that, you know. Yeah, it's scary to some people.
And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and abomination of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and I saw her and I wondered with great admiration. So in some sense, I think the engineer is a reference to Babylon, Mystery, but this title more accurately applies to Julia in the film.
Now, as a refresher, Julia was the one who helped Frank?
Yes.
Okay. This is a bit of a side note, but I just realized one of the reasons that I always found Revelation so hard to follow and like so trippy back when I was a Christian. There's just no sense of scale at all in this book. This woman has all that shit written on her forehead, but she's also sitting on top of a dragon. Like the information is so fucking dense.
Well, that's why we're allowed to infer it has a deeper meaning, that there's a historical context. And the mysteries of Thelema take a dive back into these mysteries of Babylon, and they reestablish them as sacred instead of unholy, which is what Judeo-Christianity has done. And in doing so, they're attempting to immanentize the eschaton, which means create a new age where the divine feminine is seated back, you know, up top, basically. But in order to do that, we have to unpack and dissect our own sins towards the goddess, like the position we've relegated women to in spirituality, to the idea of becoming equal with God through the secret sexual mysteries. I mean, here in Revelations, what it's referring to is the ritual consumption of the pussy juice and the jism. It is a golden cup, right? Full of the solar force, a handful of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. This is an ancient formula of initiation, is consuming. You know what I mean? We call it, what is it? It's called spitballing now. Yeah,
bodily fluid.
But it's this idea that there is divinity in the bodily fluids. And yeah, like Revelations is kind of metal. And so it sounds a bit like Clive Barker is like, you know what? If I'm going to make a horror movie or a horror book, I'm going to go back to the original horror book and just take notes. Because it looks that's like what, because okay, even the seven seals, right? You have a box, it's got 6 sides, and then once you open it, that's like the inside, the seventh seal. And that's right? And that's what initiates the whole revelation process. Immediately things start thundering, just like the bells start chiming, and you can hear like music.
Well, that's just a callback to the opening of Pandora's box, is that it just unleashes the contents of the box. You know, like the seventh seal is just the space inside of it.
Yes. I actually don't know Pandora's box off the top of my head. I don't know the mythology.
It could be summarized very briefly. A woman named Pandora is given a box by some entity. I don't remember. And this entity, I think it's Zeus, we'll just say it's Zeus, tells her, hey, bitch, don't open that box. There's evil in there. And one day she's overtaken by curiosity and opens the fucking box, and out comes pestilence and famine. Out comes murder and non-consensual fucking and all that awesome shit. She opened the box. She opened the seal.
Just like in the Tool video.
Just like in the Tool video.
Rory, this is he doesn't understand his wife, doesn't get her. This is a recurring joke in the film and in the book, but it's more like his number one torture in the book. He like can't, because things used to be so good with Julia. In the book, she's the one who's super beautiful, and then his daughter, Kirsty, she's more plain. So the way it's originally written, Julia has beauty that is beyond, but he doesn't understand her. And so the whole idea that she's mystery, Babylon the Great, is, I think it was done on purpose. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his head, and his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God to his throne. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, the great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Now, Julia, I think, is the one who's responsible for trying to make Kirsty worship Frank as if it's her father, kind of repeating this antichrist. Oh, yeah. And he is a red beast. He's pure desire, which is what the dragon represents initially.
Oh, so something interesting about this, actually, now that you mention it. All right. So is this the same beast that's referred to as the antichrist in Revelations?
There's a lot of repetition going on in Revelations. It says the beast, the dragon, it made the beast worship the dragon, and the woman made the, and it refers to it back to itself quite a bit. I'm not an expert.
Well, this is, oh, okay. Well, this is a reference, I think, in particular to the Antichrist, but it could apply here as well. The Antichrist is referred to as the beast and the only one to escape the abyss, like the only entity that can escape being cast into the abyss by God, right? Frank, the beast, comes back.
Rises from the earth.
Yeah, he manages to escape. He returns.
He's fed on the blood of the saints.
Mm-hmm. Saint John. A bunch of Saint Johns.
Okay, Mara, you read this part.
And the Virgin Mary later on. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have testimony of Jesus Christ. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon, and he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed.
All right, so Frank is the first beast. And when he incarnates again, he incarnates as the dragon or the second beast, who he is commanding the family, or Kirsty, the seed of Christ or the father, to worship him.
Right.
So he's the first beast and the second beast, and his deadly wound is healed.
And he came up, the second beast would be, had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. So this would be like when he's wearing Kirsty's dad's skin suit, like he puts on the skin of a lamb, like a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Come and to try. Daddy.
Yeah, but he's not even trying to like pretend he's another person, though, which is the creepiest part.
This beast has 2 backs.
That's like an old joke about fucking.
Don't look at me. Julia, come on, Julia. Give old Frank a kiss.
Come to Daddy.
Cheryl?
Now,
there's so many like
Cheryl.
All
right, everybody, comment below if you want a Silent Hill episode. Everybody,
have you seen Cheryl?
You're getting one anyway.
Come on, we're gonna have to do it.
Guys, like, comment, and subscribe.
Oh yeah, and click the bell to subscribe. Or subscribe and then click the bell. I forget.
Click the bell, but also worship bell.
Oh.
Everyone in Animal Crossing is like, wait, I already do.
That's an inside joke and I don't get it.
Now, there's 2 more pieces of important symbolism in the first film that we want to explore that links it back to our hypothesis before we cut people off and make them pay me $5 to hear the extended episode of www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where you can get all our episodes in their extended long format. Rory and Frank, kind of like Cain and Abel.
They're both brothers. I forgot about that.
So you got like the good brother and the bad brother. Why is the bad brother so sexy, Mari?
I don't know.
Honestly, I felt like the bad brother lost all sex appeal when he tried to fuck his niece.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. It's like MK Ultra programming.
Speaking of which, did you notice that they live on Ludovico Street?
Yes. In Clockwork Orange, the brainwashing technique is called the Ludovico technique,
which is where you're subjected to.
Okay, yeah, where they sit him in front of a movie and they play some like classical music and they inject him with some drugs that make him feel awful.
Well, it's where they turn your pleasures into torture.
Okay, yeah. It was a long time ago.
Which is what makes you into a Clockwork Orange, because you learn to associate the things you like with suffering and pain.
Hey, if you went through that and you couldn't get it, I'm not telling this joke.
So when Kirstie's in the hospital and she accidentally starts solving Le Machin's configuration, she starts to see a flower flicker on the television.
Yeah.
And we looked up what flower that was, and it opened up an entire rabbit hole. What she saw was red carnations blooming as the Cenobites were about to get her.
Ah, that's the symbol of the Virgin Mary.
It's also significant because the color red, particularly with this flower, is associated with passion.
In Victorian times, flowers were often sent as a secret, as in, you want to fuck? Red used to mean yes, and yellow meant, no, I can't do it. And in ancient Roman legend, the carnation flower appeared after the crucifixion of Christ, when Mother Mary wept at the death of her son. Her tears fell to the earth. Carnations sprang forth from each spot where Mary's tears strained the earth. This legend lends credence to the theory that the carnation earned its name from incarnation.
Oh, like to give life to.
Or an incarnation of divinity itself.
Here's something that's actually pretty fascinating that relates to a future part of this discussion. Carnations have 5 petals.
Oh, they do.
Oh, yeah.
With the engineer being the 5th and the symbol of the scarlet goddess, who is symbolized in the ancient formula with red and flowers because it's vagina.
Noise.
Yeah. 5 is also associated with Venus, which I feel is somehow relevant here. I also feel like we should bring up that we considered whether or not the engineer was associated with the Hierophant because of the number 5. And there's still like a similar kind of symbolism where he guards the keys to wherever, whatever they would call hell in this world.
Yeah, because I didn't see him as like, I mean, it makes sense that the character in the movie was like more like a hermit looking thing. But I would view it more as like a gatekeeper, the character of the engineer.
Yeah, I've honestly kind of stuck with Hierophant for him myself.
Yeah.
Where I feel like it's just that the homeless, like the hermit, was a more striking image.
Yeah, like you wouldn't expect wisdom or passage to that through him. Again, they do a nice switcheroo. Like when they change something in the movie, it actually ties back to the original book, because when you summon the Cenobites, they have that like smell of decay. And that's pretty much how that universe is of hell, is just like pretty much nastiness and decay, trash and garbage and defecation and all that. So the
results of overindulgence.
Yeah. And the fact they use the homeless man, like an old used up person that's like digging in trash just to get one more bite of food or just to afford another beer or another drug. It's just like, wow, that's kind of an interesting contrast that they use. And yeah, it ties back into the original, like, oh, wow, these are weird, like higher dimensional things that are from hell or like whatever. Like it ties in with the hell. Because in other things, notice that when demons come around, not only will it smell bad, but you'll hear flies and maggots and bugs. Mm. So it ties into that perfectly.
Beelzebub is sometimes referred to as the Lord of the Flies. I never made that connection.
Yeah, that too.
Okay.
So while the red carnations link us back to the Virgin Mary, who gave birth to the living God out of her womb. Now I'm repping for the Mary. Their house address in the film is 55 Ludovico Street. And 55 in the occult is representative also of Virgin Mary. 55 is the years that separate the Annunciation to the Assumption of the Virgin into heaven.
Oh.
It represents the total and complete man symbolized by the 2 hands which join at the moment of prayer to remake the unit in the form of 10, but being also able to express under the form of 55 addition to the senses of the divine wisdom, according to St. Martin. According to Lima of Phrytos, it symbolizes the fusion of the sexes, the androgynous being, but who, in spite of his perfection, stays strictly human. Virgin Mary's rosary is a circle formed by 55 grains. In some instances of the story, shortly before the birth of Christ, Virgin Mary was taken into the sky and was told that there would be a number of some significance given to her, and it ended up being 55. There's this idea that she suffered the same wounds that Christ suffered. So the five wounds that Christ suffered, so she suffered as well. So 5-5 is a symbol of her suffering specifically.
Such sweet suffering.
Please, no tears. It's a waste of good suffering.
Wow.
Was that an okay one?
Yeah.
Is it a good one?
It was like I'm back in the movie.
I'm not feeling it this week. The whole bit's bad. Throw it out.
Suffering is good in Christianity, right?
In some parts of it.
I mean, this is actually like a really, really interesting statement. A lot of people gravitate towards this kind of unconsciously, or like even in group discussion, it's seen as, at the very least, self-denial is seen as a good thing. You're not to touch yourself. You're not to have sexual thoughts or desires for anybody but your intended wife or husband.
Property.
Yeah, you know, and funny how that fucking works before you have a wife or husband. By the way, that's often used as a reason for everybody having sin in them is that before they met their mates, they had thoughts for people who weren't their mates. Yeah, to answer your question, yeah, there are lots of ways that manifests, but it's not like an on the books kind of thing.
Now, could we also say that the suffering one goes through for God might be seen as a sort of pleasure?
Yeah, I think so.
So I think when Frank said Jesus wept in the end, he was saying that suffering is pleasure, even in its highest, most elevated sense in terms of Western religion and Christianity.
Jesus wept.
And so we're shown images since childhood of the highest state one could aspire to is complete and total suffering.
Well, something interesting is if you're suffering or you're in complete religious ecstasy, there's actually no difference on a brain scan.
Yeah, you were talking about this earlier this week, actually, Rabbit, where you have a Nine of Swords is also indicative of laughter. Like it's indicative of both anxiety, poor mental health, and laughter.
And I think you replied saying that you had jumped into fits of laughter through sadness or suffering. And then I said in reply that I had experienced the same thing. And I think that if you just watch the Joker movie, that's part of the horror, is that he's laughing because he's suffering. And
Go ahead, Mari. Laughing is like the same thing, too. Any kind of overstimulation is actually kind of, it registers on along the same lines. So when it gets to be at that threshold, there's little differentiation between any of the different, like pleasure, pain, and joy, and suffering, and all this stuff. It starts to become the same once you get up to these higher levels of you're just overstimulated. Your brain's lit up to the point you can't comprehend it anymore. So it makes sense that some people find pleasure in that, in being driven out, because what's happening is you're going out of body with how much pain is happening.
Having a dissociative experience.
Exactly. Which basically is what a religious experience looks like.
This is also what people who you know, actual like bona fide masochists often enjoy about pain.
Yep.
Like hanging from suspension hooks.
Yeah, I get that vibe from these movies a lot because there's tons of hooks and chains. But
that shit always made my skin crawl.
Well, they call it getting in the headspace, and yeah. It is a disassociative, and it is, but you're still like the whole point of doing the masochistic thing is to you not only leaving your body, but you're also still in it because you can still feel the pain. So it's like a grounding experience, but you're still elevated, if that makes sense. Like I feel like the contrast of these things together is what makes the experience so powerful.
It's like an enema for you, the soul.
Yes. It might be uncomfortable, but afterwards it feels pretty good.
I wasn't ready for that.
Or the opposite if you're undergoing the Ludovico therapy.
Yes.
Which is the same thing, but backwards, where you're exposed to so much pleasure that it eventually becomes pain and you start to associate the things that used to give you pleasure now with pain. Whereas in the other formula, you are now like, okay, so it seems almost straightforward now to understand how a culture that's been brought up to be like, this is God being nailed
with 9-inch nails to a wooden cross and being made to suffocate and suffer. Like, this is divinity. It makes sense that we have BDSM. And like, it's not just Christian culture either. We look in Hindu culture, and part of religious ecstasy is being able to drive spikes through your body and be like, it's fine. It's fine. I'm good. Yeah. This is ecstasy to me. Yeah. This is the limits of experience. Like, I'm on the outer limits of experience. So the mysteries that pertain to the body, it's all there. It's all there in the Hellraiser. It's just like all mixed, mashed up into some spicy. I'm sure some people would actually probably love to be suspended by hooks and have stuff driven into them and all that.
Hey, I just have to put this out here before we get too far away. But fuck you, Luke. Nothing will ever make me not love an enema. I love enemas.
Can't do them all the time.
I don't know. I suddenly feels much less necessary to have said that now that I've said it. I did something last week. Nobody heard it. But, you know, if you want to hear like the extended part of this episode with all the information that we left out, you have to go to Patreon and you got to
eat carrots and shoot lasers.